Hello everyone, and welcome again to the Associated Affiliate Cricket Podcast. We have several reviews at the end of the European season to go through of matches in Czech Republic and Ireland, as well as the Jersey Peninsula, and one day series and a Sixers tournament in Africa. And to join me for that is my regular co-host, Andrew Dixon. Hi Andrew.
Hi Russ, hi everybody.
Andrew, we'll start with Africa's cricket tournament. They began with a Sixes, which included six teams, a Savagan Invitational 11, which is pretty much just a best of the South African domestic tournament that preceded it. Tanzania, Namibia, Kenya, Uganda, and Zimbabwe 11, which had only Malcolm Waller, who would probably be a first choice for Zimbabwe. Two-day cup, a lot of very high scores in very short matches that was won by South Africa fairly easily with Kenya the other finals.
Sixes cricket can be a little bit of a lottery at times. Obviously South Africa and Zimbabwe weren't fielding their full strength size by any stretch of the imagination, but it's good that Kenya managed to get to the final. And I think I read the other day that there's talk about holding this tournament again next year and probably extending it and playing two other tournaments elsewhere in Africa, maybe a tournament in Kenya and maybe one in Namibia as well, which is great thing for the future. And whether Sixes cricket has a role to play in developing cricket around the world, I'm not too sure. Obviously, rugby sevens has been very popular in recent years, and that's the form of rugby that's got into the Olympics. Whether sixes is cricket's answer for a similar answer to rugby sevens, I'm not too sure. But it's always good to see tournaments taking place like this.
Yeah, I think as much as anything, that opportunity to play and to even train with some of these professional players is probably pretty brave, particularly for a team like Tanzania who haven't necessarily played at that level particularly often.
You're absolutely right. The opportunities to play against and train with professional players, even your low-ranked professional players, is certainly not one to miss, and I'm sure it will have helped those teams a great deal.
And this was followed up, but probably more excitingly, with the ACA Cup, which was a one-day tournament, very unusual to have 50-over cricket these days outside of Asia. And in this case, we saw some really quite fine performances. Kenya were the winners, but they, except for Tanzania, who didn't manage to win a match, all the other teams did win matches and defeated both the South African and Zimbabwe sides at some point during the tournament.
It ended up being quite a close tournament, Tanzania apart. As you say, it was a 50-over tournament, which increasingly rare outside of Asia. It's actually only the second 50-over tournament outside of Asia since 2010, which gives you an idea of how rare 50-over cricket is outside the World Cricket League in regional tournaments. The actual tournament itself, Kenya did win, but as we say, it was very, very close. Going into the last day, Kenya were on 5 points, having won two and tied a game. Namibia and the Zimbabwe invitation team were both on 6 points. Kenya beat Tanzania quite convincingly the entire match was only about 35 overs. And, but to put them on 7 points, then, Uganda were on 6 points going into last day. Uganda managed to lose to Namibia. Zimbabwe, Invitation 11, lost their game against the South Africa Invitation side. And Kenya just about edged it. I mentioned earlier the tie against the South African side. A tie is often exciting in cricket. This had a bit of a farcical finish. Kenya, after being relying quite heavily on Collins Abuya and Rakit Patel, who scored 129-74. The next high score was 17. Kenya got the scores level and with two wickets still in hand, and then both those two batsmen managed to run themselves out, going for the winning run. So quite a farcical finish for that. And they, you know, they still had four balls left in the inning, so it's not as if they, it was a last ball effort to try and get a quick single to win the game. Probably a, they probably should have won that game, but it didn't come back to haunt them, and they managed to win the game. The other teams, Namibia, Jerry Snyman backs something approaching his best. He scored a couple of centuries in the tournament, which, you know, it's great to see him back playing and, you know, at, potentially at his best. He scored a century against Uganda. He scored 171 against Tanzania, just turning the clock back to when he was really dominating attacks at this level. He was, and he was scoring, I think he had a couple of innings getting up towards 190, nearly 200 at times, and it's good to see him back. Tanzania, as we've already said, were pretty poor. Uganda played reasonably well. They, if it, you know, they got pretty hammered by Namibia on the final day by 150 runs, but were, you know, they were right in there up until the end, and you know, they finished fourth, but they, you know, they won three matches and lost two, so you know, they weren't really that far behind Kenya and in the end. And I think Tanzania are part of a successful tournament for all teams.
Yeah, I think Uganda, particularly with the WCL3 coming up, probably might be a bit worried that, you know, apart from Roger Mikasa, there wasn't a lot of runs coming from the rest of their lineup.
Yeah, that was a bit worried. I highlighted it a couple of times in my reports that they were being way too reliant on Mikasa. Apart from in the game against the Zimbabwe team, where Arthur Kayobe managed to top score in that match, he had a decent partnership with Mukasa first up, and but yeah, a bit too over reliant on Mukasa, and they're gonna have, you can't in the World Cricket League, especially once you get up to Division 3, you can't just rely on one or two players. You need to have a decent team if you're gonna succeed and you'll get through to Division 2 and the, you know, the possible qualification for the Intercontinental Cup that can come from there.
And I guess we can hope that if the Sixers continue, we might actually get a similar tournament next year as well.
Yeah, that would be great. If this could become, you know, an annual or even, you know, biannual event, that would be this superb. And hopefully perhaps other regions can take note that you still can organise these 50-over tournaments. You know, obviously, these teams aren't actually playing a 2020 tournament this year. That won't come until next year. So, you know, why not give them some 50-over cricket to play, which it can help with preparing for World Cricket League tournaments, which it will do for Uganda. And then, obviously, Namibia have a World Cricket League tournament in the next 6 months as well. So it's going to help them as well. And as do Kenya, playing in Division 2 also. So, yeah, it's good preparation for World Cricket League tournaments, and you know, it's no, I don't think it's any surprise that Asian teams have tended to perform better in World Cricket League tournaments because they play more 50-over cricket internationally on a regional basis.
As well as the men's 50-over tournament, there was also a Four Nation women's 40-over tournament played in Botswana at the end of last month. It included Botswana, Mozambique, Namibia and Zimbabwe. Zimbabwe dominated the tournament. Their net run rate at the end of the points table was 4.5. But we saw some quite good performances by the home side, particularly having, they bowled out Zimbabwe in one match for 177 in their 40-over matches, although they only scored 66 in response, and defeated both Namibia and Mozambique.
Yeah, defeated Namibia and Mozambique quite easily as well. And Botswana obviously getting together a decent women's side. Perhaps they can start pushing for getting into the Women's World Cup qualifier and Women's World 2020 qualifier in the future. And it's good to see that they did manage to bowl out Zimbabwe. And a lot of, you know, earlier in the tournament, Zimbabwe had scored over 300 against Namibia, which is pretty good going in a 40-over match. When you consider that some teams struggle to score 300 in a women's 50-over match, to score it in a 40-over match is very impressive. So for Botswana to actually bowl Zimbabwe out for 177, it's great for them. It's a shame that their batting couldn't follow what the bowlers had done. They were bowled out for just 66. But in general, I think a good tournament for Botswana.
Yeah, worth adding actually, the Botswana Cricket Association notes that they're missing a number of players because of school examinations as well. I'm not sure if that's true of all the teams. So if it wasn't a full strength side, it's even better.
Yeah, if you can compete without some of your regular players, then you're a good side. It's often about how you compete when you're missing players.
The annual Jersey versus Guernsey international was also played in Andrew. The Jersey's continuing their good form, and I think their dominance of this match recently with a 6-wicket victory.
Yeah, it's the third year in a row they've won this match. It's played in Jersey at Farmers Field, which is a lovely little ground, which I think about 8 years ago was a potato field, and I was there back in 2011, and it's an absolutely superb facility, which was built by Jim Pershaw, I think, and it's a really, really superb ground. It's almost county standard, and the actual match itself, Guernsey struggled, I think it's safe to say. Guernsey at one point were 83 for 7, and it took a Thomas Kimber towards the end who scored an unbeaten 41 batting from I think number 8 to get Guernsey up to 168, with the last 3 wickets actually doubled the Guernsey score, so it could have been even worse for Guernsey. And then Jersey set off pretty quickly. Gough and Jonty Jenner put on 45 in about 8 overs. It was Gough who guided the team home, really. He scored an unbeaten 88, and Jersey won by 6 wickets. Get another win for Jersey, and disappointing for Guernsey, who have had quite a disappointing year, really. Joining us now on the Associate and Affiliate podcast is Subhash Jayaraman, who currently on a world tour around the world, and his latest stop was in Ireland to watch the first 2 Ireland v Scotland games, and he's here to talk about that. Thanks for coming on the show, Subhash.
It's absolutely my pleasure, Andrew. Thanks for having me.
So as I just said, you went to the first 2 games. What were your thoughts on the 2 games?
I expected Ireland to win the series, even though they were playing with slightly understrength squad, based on what Ireland have done recently, and especially they've been playing quite well, and it turned out that way. But the final margin, 2-1, seems a lot closer than what it indicates, because I thought Scotland got the wrong end of the deal by losing the toss in the first 2 matches and being put into bat, and Craig Young coming in and Sorensen used the new ball really well, where it was swinging as well as seaming, and Scotland top order was exposed. So I wonder what would have happened if Scotland were to chase in the first 2 games rather than Ireland chasing the small Scotland scores, because Scotland definitely showed in the 3rd match that they're quite capable of doing that. So I wonder what would have happened if Scotland were chasing. I think the series result could have been different, and Ireland would be ruining the fact that their top players didn't play in the series. Some of the top players anyway.
Yeah, looking at the live stream and what the match reports said, the conditions early on in the day were definitely conducive to seam bowling.
Mm-hmm. It was. I was there for 2 matches, and both matches, there had to be a pitch inspection closer to the time of the toss because the outfield was wet. So which meant that there was plenty of moisture on the ground, which means the pitch was juiced up a little. So there was plenty of, seam movement available. And credit to Ireland that they took full advantage of it. But, that's the way it goes, I suppose. You go in knowing fully well that you're at the mercy of a coin toss. So,
and we've been talking about the bowling so far. Anything impressive with the batting overs, the century in the 2nd game from Richie Berrington?
Oh, that century was proper professional cricketer's 100. Richard, I was really impressed with how he constructed that 100. I think he eventually got 100 of 125 balls, and he came in when they were 43 for 5 or something like that. He constructed the way he constructed the innings, and he farmed the strike, and batted with the lower order. That guy was a proper professional cricketer. How he made the 100 was very impressive. And in the first match, I was kind of wondering what Callum McLeod was doing, because he was going after the bowling very early, even though the bowlers had the advantage. That would have worked out if it was slightly flatter pitch. And I thought Scotland's plan early on was like playing it as a T20 rather than a 50-over match, and they tried to go for everything and got out themselves there, rather than waiting for Ireland to come to them. But I guess by the end of the series, they have figured out, recalibrated their batting strategy, and that showed in the third match.
Moving on now to this world tour you're on in general, where else do you go from here?
I got back from Ireland to London a couple of days ago, and we head to India on Monday, which is tomorrow, and then we stay there for a month, and then we move on to UAE, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, South Africa, and then finally to the World Cup in Australia, New Zealand.
And will you see Ireland and Scotland in the World Cup or any of the other
I have tickets for an Ireland game. I don't have tickets for Scotland game, any of the Scotland games, but I'm hoping I'll be able to go up to the doors and buy one on the day of the match and walk in. And also I have have tickets to a couple of Afghanistan games.
We should be very excited to see Afghanistan play. They're a much, much improving side in current years.
Absolutely. And, any team that has proper bowling lineup is always fun to watch. You're always in the game, no matter what format you're talking about. Mm-hmm. If you have a proper set of bowlers, and Afghanistan's got that, which will make them a very exciting prospect. Hopefully they, they get a few, big scalps during the tournament, and that'll make a whole tournament come alive.
Those who follow you on Twitter will be aware that you live in the US and you're married to an American, recently became an American citizen. Do you keep up with what's going on in US cricket, which is often quite farcical, of course?
I keep track in terms of the lot more off the field stuff than on the field stuff, because there's hardly any on the field going on with the the ICC supported official organization. I do keep track of what's going on in the ACF side of things, because the league that I used to play till last year, it's a Washington Metropolitan Cricket League, a cricket board, and that's part of ACF. So that way I keep track of the goings-on there, and I have friends playing all over the country in various leagues, so that way I keep track of goings-on there. But the off-the-field stuff seems to be the one that seems to capture most of people's interest. So generally I try to keep track of that, and you have Peter and Jamie and all others that keep us posted on all those things, yeah.
And obviously your wife is with you on this world tour, so you have personal experience, I suppose, of getting Americans interested in cricket. Is it as hard as people seem to think it is?
No, it's not, actually. It is not. It's just that you have to take the time to understand the sport. Anybody can, cricket is in my blood, this and that, but you actually understand the sport and enjoy the sport for what it is. It's quite easy to explain to others. When you have passion and love about something and you want to really get more people involved, it's very easy to do. Instead of trying to complicate everything, lay things out slowly, and then get them in over time. It's like a test match. It doesn't happen in one day. It has to slow cook, slow burn all the way over 5 days. That makes it test match as great as it is. And that's what you need to do when you bring people that have absolutely no background in the cricket. It's a slow burn. Eventually, they'll get there too, They're also human beings. They have same intellect, IQ levels as anybody else. So to say that, Americans won't get cricket is just bollocks.
I'd certainly agree with that. Any American who actually seems to watch cricket tends to become a big fan of cricket. I can't think of anybody who
once they make the effort to actually watch cricket, doesn't start enjoying it, who's an American? You see, obviously, Peter De La Penna, as we've already mentioned, Jamie Harrison. You see, you have as occasional sort of tradition to send a baseball writer over to watch a test match, and he comes back talking about how great it was. And you know, cricket, I think there is something about cricket that perhaps appeals to Americans rather than the other way around.
Absolutely, absolutely, I think so. Because cricket is not just, you know, something that you come in and get done in halves, two halves of 45 minutes each, and then you go home, you know, because this it demands certain amount of dedication from the people trying to watch it. And you have to do the appropriate, you know, background work, and it allows you to think it in so many different ways, and the match can go so many different ways. Anything can happen in a given instant, so you need to pay attention, you know, keep track of what's going on in front of you, and then, you know, and if you agree to the fact that, yeah, it is, it can take a long time, but it satisfies you intellectually, and you should take whatever it gives you, then, you know, with an open mind, you'll have a lot of fun. And cricket is, I mean, it's, I'm not saying that because I'm a lifelong cricket fan, but it's one of the greatest sports that we have in terms of how it, you know, unfolds over 5 days or one day or whatever, and you know, satisfies something deep within you rather than just, you know, like, yeah, my team won.
Yeah, people probably best know you for the Cricket Couch podcast. You've also had a few guests from associate members, some of the same guests we've had on this show. But do you find that players and officials from associate members are sometimes more open with themselves than players and officials from full member nations?
More open with themselves, you said?
More open with what they say about the game, and
yeah, I think
easier
so
to approach.
I think so, and you know, I don't blame the people from full member nations for that, because, you know, the moment you have something to lose, you try to become more guarded, more reserved. You don't want to say anything controversial, right? So that is human nature. But yeah, when people from associate and affiliate nations come along, like someone like Ross Brooks or Jamie or Peter or whoever, they come on, they give you, you know, the unvarnished truth. They see cricket in the grassroots, and they understand exactly what's going on, and they're not afraid of saying what they see, you know, and we should have a lot more of that. Not just in cricket, in affiliate or associate cricket, but in full member nation, but generally in life, that's a good principle to live by. That to call things as you see it.
And I suppose as an interviewer, you appreciate that.
Oh, absolutely! You know, that's the best part of it. You know, if you can, and it becomes you know, going in, you kind of know certain people may not want to talk about certain topics, etc., but that's a challenge to me. I try to find ways without being exactly direct, but still, you know, wanting to investigate into the topic, and having them, you know, once they're on for 10-15 minutes, they usually tend to open up a little bit more, because they feel that they've established a sense of trust with me as the interviewer, and they're a little bit more open to talk about certain things. But yeah, there are still certain lines they won't cross, but, you know, I'll take it whatever I can, however far I can push them. So, you know, it's an ongoing process, learning process for me. And, you know, every time I find a new guest with certain topics to talk about, and I, you know, not completely comfortable pushing them. But then eventually, if I succeed, get over my own inhibitions, and then allow them to get over theirs, you know, that makes for generally a very good interview. So it's a process for me.
So that just about wraps it up. So thanks for coming on the show. It's much appreciated.
Yeah, Andrew, thank you for having me. It's my pleasure.
Both the Irish women's and men's teams have been playing as well, Andrew. I guess we'll start with the men. They were playing Scotland in a 3-1-day series at the Malahide, They won the first by 7 wickets, the second by 3 wickets, but were turned over in the third by 8 wickets by Scotland.
So this series, I suppose, important as part of the preparation for
the World Cup, or the guy decide will actually play another one-day international until the World Cup now, unless there's something been scheduled that we don't know about yet. Quite low scoring, all three matches really. The first game, Scotland bowled out for 172, with only really Michael Leask putting in any sort of decent performance there. With the bat, he scored 50. Craig Young in that game on ODI debut took 5 for 46. He's only the ninth bowler to take 5 wickets or more in on ODI debut. Obviously, you know, great for him. Ireland knocks off the runs with very little trouble. Kevin O'Brien scoring 56. Second ODI, Scotland did have a century. Barrington scored 101, but again, not much else than the rest of the team, and they were bowled out for 221. Which again, Ireland knocked off relatively easily. Kevin O'Brien again, 67. I think that was his third ODI 50 in a row. The third game, Scotland played a lot better. They restricted Ireland to 241. John Mooney, who was to come back to the side for this tournament after his battle with depression. If any listeners haven't already heard, it was an excellent interview with him on the RTE website about his battle with depression, which I think is a must listen for absolutely everybody who is interested in cricket in general, not just associate cricket. He scored 96, which is good to see him back in some form. Scotland, Callum McLeod, who's had a superb year really. He's scored a unbeaten century to help take them to an 8-wicket win, so a consolation win for Scotland. But they were disappointed they didn't compete better, I think, against an Ireland side that had been weakened much more than the Scotland side by players playing county cricket instead of this series.
I think they'll be at the very least happy with the consolation win, though. It would be, I think, a bit of a worry going to the World Cup if they'd lost all three games relatively easily to Ireland. And I think that final game, managing to put together a decent total and to pull out the wins, probably at least something to take as they go towards next year.
Yeah, obviously, when it comes to the World Cup itself, they're going to be coming against much stronger opposition and sides who aren't going to, as in the second ODI, Scotland at one point were 11 for 3, and a stronger side than Ireland isn't going to let you come back and score 221. They're going to bowl you out for under 100. And so Scotland, I think, have a bit of work to do with their batting, especially that upper order, Callum McLeod apart. But yeah, they'll be pleased with that consolation win, but I think they'll probably think they should have done a little better than that. I think they were probably aiming to win the series, maybe 2-1, if not 3-0, and I think they'll be disappointed overall, but as we say, pleased with that final win.
And looking at both sides, the low scoring, it has to be a bit of a worry, given that the expectation in Australia and New Zealand is that the games are probably going to be very high scoring up towards 300. Obviously, the different conditions in Ireland, but you'd like to see scores in the mid 200s, really, rather than the low 200s in this kind of match. It's not necessarily very the same types of preparation that they need.
Yeah, and the conditions weren't perfect by any stretch of the imagination. Did sort of brighten up towards the end of the day, but I think all three games had a delayed start due to a damp outfield. It was very foggy at the start of the third ODI, and conditions weren't made for high scoring by any stretch of the imagination, but even so, even in those conditions, you still would probably be expecting to be making 250, 260, and when you're only making 220, 230, it's a little worrying for the future, and we'll see what they work on over the winter with their preparation tours initially, and then going on to the World Cup.
And the Irish women had a 3-2020 match series against South Africa. This was played in England, part of South Africa's English tour. It was good that they managed to get these games in. The Irish team probably will be a little disappointed in how it went. They beaten all three games relatively easy, although they did actually probably compete a little bit better as the series went on. They lost the first by 56 runs, the second by 46 runs, and then won the third by 6 wickets, but with only 7 balls marooned.
Yeah, they certainly got better as the series went on. I think Ireland's problem is probably more their batting. Isabel Joyce apart, there isn't really much to that batting lineup. It's quite brittle, as it were. Isabel Joyce had a superb series with bat and ball. In the first game, she took 3 for 16, and then in the last game, she scored 45. So obviously, the Joyce family runs deep in Irish cricket. Obviously, Ed Joyce, probably by far the best batsman Ireland have ever produced, having a superb season in county cricket at the moment, and Isabel is his sister. And she's had a good series. I think they probably competed a little bit better than they did in the World 2020 earlier this year, which is good to see, but they've now this was the last series in charge for Trent Johnston, who's really brought the Irish women on this year, and it'd be interesting to see how they get on without him in next year and in the future.
Joining us now on the Associate and Affiliate Cricket Podcast is Czech Republic National Team Manager Dan Casey. Thanks for coming on the show, Dan.
Hi, Andrew. Thanks for having me on.
Czech Republic recently hosted the Central Europe Cup, also involving Poland, Switzerland and Luxembourg. Wasn't a successful tournament for Czech Republic, who finished last, but what are your thoughts on the tournament in general?
Well, it was a very nice occasion, certainly, and a very enjoyable tournament that went down to a thrilling finish. It was good to meet a lot of these guys and get together in the name of cricket, and we certainly had a good weekend, helped by the glorious late summer weather here in Prague.
And you mentioned it went right down to the wire. The last game, it went right down to the last over, didn't it, between Poland and Switzerland?
Yes, Poland played very well in that game, and the Swiss batting up to that point, they'd got nearly up. I think they were averaging 180 in the first two games, and then the Poles held them to 140. And then they batted, very, very sensibly, and they should have had to chase the target down inside 18 overs, but in the end the Czechs fell short against Luxembourg, which meant that Poland just needed the head-to-head win, and so they were able to take the foot off the gas a little bit and just ease home, and they did very well.
This tournament, as people will know, is sort of outside of the official ICC Europe tournament structure, but do ICC Europe provide any sort of support for these tournaments?
To be honest, we didn't even really ask about it much. We were happy to sort of pull this together, do it on a fairly informal basis, and we didn't really go looking for umpires. We gave it as a chance for our local league umpires to develop, and we received good feedback from the other nations about that. They were happy with the quality of the umpiring. Also, Switzerland brought along a qualified umpire, and otherwise we didn't really need much to put it on.
In terms of what ICC Europe sort of think about these tournaments, do they encourage you to still play these tournaments, or would they rather you be sort of playing just local domestic cricket?
They haven't really told us much about it. I think they're happy to see such things happen, but obviously at the moment the main focus is development among the regions, but I don't know, I think the balance might have got a bit out of whack, and they're maybe not appreciating how much of an impact the national teams can have on development locally.
And do you think there may be a rethink on bringing more teams back into the divisional structure in future?
For me, it's a little bit confusing how they've got these divisions of six, but they've raised the bar quite high, and what, we've got 13 teams outside the tournament structure?
Yeah.
I would think another division of six would make sense. I can't see why we can't have a division four, because, so for example, for us, we right now we've got nothing to aim for. You know, the bar's very high. We would have to overtake Luxembourg and a number of other teams just to have a chance at being the team that would go into Division 3 if they needed an extra team, which, yeah, it's just not realistic for us at the moment. So, yeah, it's a little bit uncertain, you know, what we're aiming for exactly.
I suppose having something to aim for through a sort of tournament pathway can actually help attract people to the game as well.
Absolutely. There's a whole, you know, it's a different ball game if you tell people that you're involved in, you know, the path to the World Cup, however theoretical it might be. It just, you know, puts an extra smile on people's faces, gets a bit more interest and
helpful for sponsors, I suppose, as well.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, at the same time, a tournament like we had last weekend is also sort of as effective, because we can put it under the national team banners, and you know, we all know that we're a long way from the World Cup, so you know, just having a tournament like this is an interesting local event. Locals were genuinely you know, amazed to know that four European teams were gathering on a field in Prague.
Moving back to the sort of more the tournament itself, any particular players stand out for you on any team, not just the Czech Republic?
Well, certainly Poland have got a very talented bowler, Vinit Sina. He didn't perform so much in the last game, but against Luxembourg he sparked to life and he had a triple wicket maiden. And then
very,
against
very
us,
useful in a 2020.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, he was just a different class in terms of pace. Against the Czechs, we knew we'd done well in bowling Poland out for 119, but then Mr. Sina came on with his first ball, just scorched our opener's middle stump out. So and I think in that game we ended up with four golden ducks, and it was. I mean, we were 8 for 4 after three overs, and compared to their start when they had 36 for nothing off three overs, we did very well to come back and win that game, really.
And for those people who aren't aware, what are the facilities like in Czech Republic for this tournament and for other matches?
Well, we were able to have such a tournament because this year we've laid down two quality carpet wickets at the same facility. The second one went down just a month ago, so it's still quite fresh, but they're playing nicely. They're not quite as bouncy as you see in a lot of European countries where they play on just concrete and then carpet on top. We've got gravel underneath instead. But yeah, it's private farmland because, I mean, you know, the steps we've taken just over the last decade, and I mean, I remember 5 years ago, we were playing on a public park, and we couldn't get the grass cut in the outfield. You were hitting cover drives that would just, you know, stick 10 meters away.
obviously, the cricket season's pretty much over now. What's in the pipeline for the Czech Republic next year?
Well, definitely we want to host another tournament like this. This was a great success for us this year, and we're very fortunate in our location. We're right in the centre of Europe, but we haven't been overly affected by the West, so our prices are still pretty cheap. So, yeah, combine that with the accessibility, and we've got a good option there for a lot of teams. We would definitely look to get on the road as well to give our national team some extra practice there. We're surrounded a bit by Germany and Austria nearby to us, which obviously gives us great partners to work with for the future, because those guys have got much more developed cricket scenes, and they'll be able to give our national team good experience for now, and you know, in the future as we develop, we'll be able to bring up under 19, under 15 teams and take those next door as well.
Well, I think that just about wraps it up, so thanks once again for coming on the show, Dan.
Thanks for having me.
In the final news out of Europe, probably the last match we played in Europe this year, I think, was the Central European Cup that was played in the Czech Republic. We just heard from Dan Casey, Andrew. Quite a short tournament, but the non-ICC members were the dominant ones there, that with Poland winning and Switzerland coming second.
Yeah, very intriguing that, I suppose. You're obviously, Poland and Switzerland, of course, get no ICC funding, whereas Luxembourg and the Czech Republic do get some. So you do perhaps have to question just what Luxembourg and the Czech Republic are doing with their ICC funding. But you know, it's good, as we always say about this, it's good to see these tournaments being played. And it was covered very well as well. There was scorecards uploaded pretty quickly after the end of the day's play on all 3 days, and was organised very well. And the teams were willing to play as well. They had a bit of a rain shower, I think, on one afternoon, but the teams still managed to play in pretty poor conditions at one point, which is, you know, it's good to see that they were keen to play and compete. And obviously Poland and Switzerland ended up playing each other in the final match, which turned out to be the decider, which Poland won, as Dan talked about in his interview. And yeah, a very, I think, a successfully run tournament by all accounts. And you know, hopefully organising these tournaments can perhaps give ICC Europe some ideas that, you know, maybe they can get involved more with organising these tournaments. I've found out that they do occasionally supply umpires or cricket balls or scorers and whatnot for these tournaments. They didn't in the case of the Central European Cup, but I believe they have done for some of the other tournaments in Europe this summer, which is good. Obviously, I think I'd prefer it if these were part of a not necessarily a divisional structure, but a sort of pyramid structure where you have the little sub-regional tournaments feeding into the national division tournaments. Just so you have regional tournaments feeding into the World Cricket League. I think that sort of pyramid system probably works better because it's cheaper, because you can have the teams closer together. You know, we've spoke about this before, and I don't think anybody listens to us on this regard.
Yeah, I think the next step too for these nations who are organising is if to try and get together, and if the ICC can't organise it, to create their own sub-pyramidal structure such that it doesn't just end with a tournament in one nation that they could allow themselves to have, say, a final or something that perhaps would round out their seasons.
Yeah, you could have a sort of a Central European Cup, an Eastern European Cup, a Western European Cup, and then the winners of each one all join each other in a big tournament at the end of the season. That could be something they'll look at next year, and you know, I'd like to see it. And if that can become, that can perhaps send some messages to ICC Europe that, you know, these teams are being successful. They're playing in competitive international cricket and competing well in it, and maybe that can help get these teams back into the official formal ICC Europe tournament structure.
And I guess also to send a message to the ICC that it is possible to do these sort of tournaments on a limited budget.
Yeah, absolutely. And we've spoken about this before. I think this needs to happen, and if it can happen in future, it would be absolutely superb.
As part of the preparations for the Asian Games, Hong Kong has been touring Sri Lanka with both their men's and women's teams, which is good to see, Andrew. The little bit of a disappointing tour, though. I'm not sure that actually either side won matches. They play the Army with both the men's and women's in the T20 matches. Quite a high scoring match. The Hong Kong men lost by 20 runs and the women by 45 runs. There was in matches against the Navy. A very, very strong Sri Lankan A side, which defeated Hong Kong. Hong Kong was bowled out for made only 9 for 83 after 20 overs, and then in a revised score, Sri Lanka A chased 3 for 161 in their match. And then a match against the Hobart Hurricanes, who were preparing for the Champions League, which Hong Kong made 121, which is an improved performance, but the Hurricanes chased it down in 12 overs, which was probably a little bit of a disappointment with their bowling.
Yeah, and Hong Kong, I suppose, are coming off a couple of months without any cricket, so we expect them to be a bit rusty, but you know, unfortunately they've had quite a poor tour. I suppose adjusting to the conditions in Sri Lanka is always difficult if you don't have the experience of playing there as well. But I think this was more about getting together as a team and preparing for the Asian Games. Hong Kong, of course, aren't fielding the strongest side for the Asian Games, because the Asian Games requires everybody to be a Hong Kong passport holder, and not many of the full-strength side are Hong Kong passport holders. So it's by no means the full-strength Hong Kong side. It's not the same Hong Kong side that beat Bangladesh earlier in the year, for example. They'll be disappointed that they didn't get a win, but again, it was more about just preparation more than anything.
In the ICC organised tours of Australia have started with the UAE and Afghanistan heading over there. The UAE lost to the West Australian side by 38 runs in a 50-over match there, which was pretty good performance, because they're generally reasonably strong domestic sides in Australia. And so just no one really got going with the runs, though. The West Australia making 245 and the UAE bowled out for 207.
Yeah, I mean, Western Australia's innings was, I suppose, dominated just by 119 from Cameron Bancroft. There wasn't really much else in that innings. Had they managed to get him out early, then perhaps it would have been a different story. But actually, apart from Bancroft's entry, UAE bowled pretty well. Manjula Gurungi took 6 for 30, which a fantastic performance in one day cricket, six wickets. And the batting perhaps wasn't too good. They had a number of batsmen sort of get a start, but nobody really sort of kick on and get the big total, the big score that they needed to win the game. And they were bowled out for 207 in the end. Couldn't even bat out their overs, which is disappointing. The tour continues. They'll have played Western Australia again by the time this podcast goes out, and then they move to Darwin, where they'll play Papua New Guinea, Northern Territory, and South Australia. Good to see Papua New Guinea getting a game, although it won't be an ODI because the ground it's being played on isn't approved to host ODIs, which is disappointing for Papua New Guinea. They've still not played an ODI since getting the status back in January. A reasonable start to the tour for the UAE, and they'll hope to perhaps win the second game against Western Australia and then move on and do well against the other teams they're playing in Darwin.
The UAE will be followed into Australia by Afghanistan, who will be playing also against West Australia in Perth, and then New South Wales second 11 in Canberra before heading off to New Zealand to play Auckland and Northern Districts at the end of the month.
It's interesting that Afghanistan have essentially split their side between the Asian Games, which we'll talk about in a little while, and this tour. Of the full Afghanistan side, I think Mohammad Nabi and a couple of the players are going to the Asian Games, and then everybody else is playing on this tour of Australia and New Zealand. So it'd be interesting to see how they go without their captain. I'm assuming he will join the tour once the Asian Games are over with. Very surprising that he's not taking part in this, given its importance in preparing for the World Cup. It's a bit of a shame that the ICC scheduled this to coincide with the Asian Games. Obviously, with the Asian Games not being an ICC tournament, I suppose the ICC aren't obligated to ignore it when they're coming up with their schedules, but perhaps they should have done so that Afghanistan could have had a full strength side at both events.
Moving on to the Asian Games, then, Andrew, it's running from the 20th of September until October the 3rd. There's, as we've discussed before, a women's tournament and then a men's tournament. It's a slightly unusual format in that the women's tournament will be played in the first week of the games and then the men's tournament in the second. There's only one ground, so the pitches by the end of the men's tournament might end up being a bit interesting, but potentially given how much use it's going to get over those 2 weeks. Because of the uneven number of teams, there's preliminary rounds in the first couple of days and then moving on to quarterfinals and then semifinals. Some teams have a straight run into the quarterfinals, and just possibly the best way to go about it, given that there's probably a fairly uneven strength between the teams. So starting with the women's Group C, the two groups with three teams in it. Group C has China, Hong Kong, and South Korea, and Group D has Thailand, Nepal, and Malaysia, with Japan, Sri Lanka, Pakistan, and Bangladesh seeded. Starting at Group C, China would almost certainly get out of that group, you think?
I think almost certainly. China definitely the strongest side in that group. Hong Kong will push them all the way. South Korea, a bit of an unknown quantity. This is the first time they've ever fielded a women's side in any tournament. There's been a lot of talk about the men's side converting baseball players. I'm not sure if the women's side has done anything similar. We'll see how they go. I can't see them challenging China and Hong Kong too much, though.
Yeah, and the winner of that group will play Japan in the quarterfinal, which means that one of Japan or China or Hong Kong will almost certainly get into the opportunity to win a medal, and the other team will get to play Sri Lanka, which is itself a big opportunity, I guess.
Runners up get to play against Sri Lanka isn't exactly a good prize for the runners up. If it's seeded well, then I suppose that's what you'd expect. Sri Lanka, I think, sending pretty much their full strength women's side to this tournament, so you would expect Sri Lanka to get through to that semi final. But that quarter final one, which will be between Japan and either China or Hong Kong, could be a very interesting match. Could be probably the best of the quarterfinals.
And in the other group, you'd probably expect Thailand to win. It might be a bit of a poison chalice, though, because the winner of this group has to play Pakistan, whereas the runner-up gets to play Bangladesh.
I'm not sure what the strength of the Pakistan and Bangladesh women's sides are in this tournament. Sri Lanka are by far and away the best side in the tournament, also with India not playing. That sort of tie goes to Sri Lanka. So you'd expect Thailand and Nepal to come through, although Malaysia will probably quite challenge Nepal. Thailand will probably come up against Pakistan and then Nepal against Bangladesh. And you'd expect the two full members to win those quarterfinals and get through to the semi-final. I suppose it's good experience for these teams.
And in the men's tournament, similar format. The Group A in this case has Malaysia, China, and South Korea, with the winner going on to play Hong Kong and the second team playing Sri Lanka.
I think you'd expect Malaysia to top this group and play Hong Kong in the quarterfinals. China's men's team has underperformed, I think it's safe to say, in recent years, and I'll be interested to see how they go against South Korea. I'll be interested to see how South Korea go in general with the converting baseball players. We saw on their tour of Fiji, they either seem to make a big score or get out for not very much. And you're playing at home, whether they can get a crowd behind them, who knows how they're going to do. It'll certainly be intriguing to see how the converted baseball players get on. They still do have some of the a few long time members of the Korean cricket team. There's, I think, three or four players who played in the last Korean team that played in the Pacific, East Asia Pacific T20 qualifier back in 2011, I think. So you know, there's still some established cricket players, if you like, in the side. But yeah, I think it's probably one of the most intriguing stories in cricket at the moment, how these converted baseball players will do.
The other group, which leads to some intriguing quarterfinals, is Nepal Q8 and Maldives. Nepal will be extremely disappointed if they don't book a quarterfinal against Afghanistan.
Yeah, I think Nepal are perhaps justifiably annoyed that they haven't been seeded in the quarterfinals. It was Hong Kong are and Afghanistan are the associate members that have been seeded, along with Bangladesh and Sri Lanka. And Nepal are a better 2020 side than Hong Kong. We saw that in the World 2020, where Nepal finished second in the group. And you know, Nepal beat Hong Kong in the last ACC 2020 Cup and tended to beat Hong Kong in 2020 cricket. So I think Nepal justifiably annoyed that. And then they'll get Afghanistan. But as we've already mentioned, Afghanistan have a weakened side in this. So you know, that you could well see Hong Kong get through to the quarterfinals. Normally, with the other team that goes through to the quarterfinals, you'd normally expect Kuwait to beat the Maldives, but Kuwait nowhere near full strength. Kuwait are the first Arab team to play in one of the Asian Games tournaments, and people may be aware that it's actually very hard for immigrants to get passports in Arab countries, and Kuwait is no exception. So this is, you're by no means the full strength Kuwait side. So you might expect the Maldives to come through and get through to that quarterfinal. We should probably point out that due to the way the draw works, the semi-finals will see the winners of the Hong Kong Malaysia match in one, and then one other quarterfinal, Afghanistan will also play an associate, and then the winners of those two quarterfinals will meet in the semi-final, which means that we will see an associate side in the final, which is an intriguing way of setting the draw. You can't imagine the ICC would allow that to happen. You're almost certainly, shall I say a rig? Yeah, I will say a rig. The draw to make sure to increase the chances of the final being played between the two full members, but obviously the Asian Games Council have no such worries, and an associate side is guaranteed at least a silver medal, which is great for whichever associate that will be.
Yeah, it's somewhat interesting way of doing it, because also the second place team in each group, in theory, ends up playing in one of the semi-finals as opposed to the first place in the other. So it seems it's kind of crossed around somehow. But say it'd be good, certainly good publicity for one of those teams to come away with a medal of some sorts, a silver or gold.
Yeah, you know, we saw in 2010 that Afghanistan got the silver medal in the men's tournament. Japan got a bronze medal in the women's tournament. There was only two full members in the women's tournament last time. This time there's three. But, you know, who knows what will happen in that final? Bangladesh, I think you'd probably make just favourites of that. Although Sri Lanka have a strong side, Bangladesh are sending pretty much their full strength side. I think they're only missing maybe one player from a full strength Bangladesh 2020 side. So you'd probably just make them favourites. It'd be very interesting to see what happens in that final. You know, because Bangladesh have lost to Afghanistan in one day cricket this year and Hong Kong in 2020 cricket. So they are vulnerable, and you know, a team that gets to a final against Bangladesh could well find themselves winning the gold medal.
The other big tournament we need to preview is Africa Division 2. There are either six or seven teams involved in this tournament, depending on whether Sierra Leone attends. Obviously, had issues with the Ebola crisis that's preventing them from travelling to other tournaments. The other teams will be Zambia, Nigeria, Ghana, Seychelles, Mozambique, and Swaziland. I guess would be a bit of a surprise if Nigeria weren't the team to come out of this tournament.
Yeah, I think there's actually two teams to be promoted to Division 1. I think you'd expect Nigeria to be top, and then maybe it's probably between Ghana and Zambia for the second spot. I don't see any of the other teams getting close. Unfortunately, we don't know much more about this tournament. ICC Africa, again, are very light on providing information about their tournaments. But yeah, I think Nigeria is probably to win, and then between Ghana and Zambia for that second promotion spot.
Moving on to some news, Andrew. The ICC Academy at the Dubai Sports Centre and the Emirates Cricket Board have made a long-term strategic partnership together, which is good for UAE cricket to cement having the ICC Academy there and those facilities, which are used by quite a number of teams. Obviously, Pakistan, as they play there a lot, and certainly help UAE cricket, judging by the improvement over the last couple of years.
UAE has probably the best facilities in the associate world, thanks to the fact that it's basically Pakistan's home ground at the moment. As well as this arrangement, there'll also be four ODIs against Afghanistan, which is very good. It was an extra preparation for the World Cup. And then matches for the UAE against Pakistan A, again against a New Zealand 11. I'm not sure if that New Zealand are scheduled to play in the UAE against Pakistan, and I think there is a gap in the schedule, so whether that turns into a full ODI against New Zealand would be great. It'd be UAE's first game against a test playing country for quite a while in one day international cricket. Australia are also touring the UAE, but I've not heard anything about any games against Australia for the UAE, and same, no games between the UAE and Pakistan, which is disappointing that all these teams are coming to the UAE and not playing the UAE, but the schedules are such now that they're very tightly packed, and it's hard to find room, which is disappointing. You'd like to see, if a team is playing in the UAE, they should be playing the UAE in Afghanistan, of course. It also use the UAE as their home ground, and it's a bit disappointing. But in general, I think this arrangement will certainly bring a lot of benefit to UAE cricket, who have, they've just started to issue contracts to their players and start to professionalise the game in the country a little bit, which is a good sign for the future.
Speaking of professionalising the game, the Cricket Association of Nepal have appointed a CEO and a finance officer, have reached that point, which is good for them. It was a point of contention at the ICC meeting that they need to organise themselves better than they had been, and this will be a big step forward for them in terms of their having a single point of contact and someone who can actually run the organisation professionally. Hopefully they pick the right person for the job.
They were facing suspension had they not managed to get this sorted out by the ICC annual conference next year, which would be disastrous given how well they've done in the last couple of years. Obviously, they got to the World 2020 performed reasonably well there, and they've been doing very well in regional Asian tournaments as well, and if they ended up getting suspended, that would have been disastrous, I think, for Nepali cricket. But hopefully they've got their act together now and can administer themselves a little better than they have otherwise been doing.
In not entirely improving on the disastrous administration, Kenya's announced the replacement for Jackie J. Muhammad, and somewhat surprisingly, it's actually Jackie J. Muhammad.
Yeah, we say surprisingly, and unfortunately I don't think it is particularly surprising. She seems to have been hanging around Kenyan cricket for quite a while now, and we said on the last episode that perhaps this was time for Kenya to turn a corner, and well, it doesn't look like it is going to be, and whether she's changed and she'll actually do things differently now she's got her job back, I don't know, but it doesn't look particularly good for Kenyan cricket.
In somewhat better news, that Namibia's cricket board has patched things up with the local media. They've had a long-going feud because of accusations of racism from the local media regarding the selection of sides, and so, which is probably not something you want, because obviously it means that your games aren't being reported. Hopefully now the movie and cricket can forge a partnership with their local media and to actually promote the game in there and not actually be in a position where they're feuding with each other.
It's always good to have the media on side. USACA doesn't seem to care about having the media on side, as people who follow Peter De La Penna will be aware. They seem to do everything they can to annoy the media, and it's the same in some other countries as well. And if you can have good relations with the media in the country, then it can only help your cause when you're trying to promote your sport in a crowded sporting marketplace. If you've got local media along with you, then it's only beneficial.
And speaking of USACA, they have decided that they will be sending a team to Rookery League Division 3. It was probably not really up in the air that they would. I'm not sure what the ICC would look upon it terribly fondly. But Uganda, one of the concerns was terrorism in Uganda, and there has been an emergency message from the US Embassy as of yesterday of a disruption of an Al-Shabaab terrorist plot. So that may change again. Hopefully not.
It wouldn't be an episode of this show without some USACA news. Hopefully the team will get there. Whether it will be a full strength US side, I think, remains to be seen. I can see a few players perhaps pulling out due to these concerns. And you'd hope that if there are specific threats against the US Embassy and US nationals in Uganda, that the ICC will provide extra security, as they have done in the past. They did when the USA played in the 2010 World 2020 qualifier, when they played Afghanistan in the UAE. They have done in the past for when Israel played in Malaysia back in 1997, they provided extra security for them. And when there are specific threats, the ICC usually are very good at providing that extra security, and hopefully they will on this occasion. If that will placate the voices in US cricket that don't want this tour to go ahead.
And finally, news, Andrew, the jersey has been chosen to host ICC Europe Division 1 next year. The previous couple had been in England, so it's moving back to the islands for this, the 16 tournament, again with Guernsey, Italy, Denmark, France and Norway.
I think this is a good move. I've not been a fan of this trend to have the tournaments in England. I appreciate that England has good facilities, but then, as I mentioned earlier, Jersey does have good facilities as well, and it's good to see it back in one of the host countries. Obviously, Jersey has turf wickets, which means that you're playing on quality pitches in good facilities, and Jersey is an expensive place that could harm the budget a little bit, perhaps, which is one of the reasons why they moved towards tournaments to England in the first place. But it's only a 6-team tournament now rather than the 12-team tournament that Division 1 was in 2013 and 2011. And so, and it's good to see, as I say, it back in a host country. And I suppose it gives Jersey and maybe Guernsey as well a chance at challenging Denmark and Italy.
And that's all there is today. Thanks, Andrew.
Thanks, Russ, as always.